Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving arts scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we'll sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. The conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we are talking to two of Richmond's prominent art historians, Dr. Howard Rosati and Dr. James Farmer. Welcome to you both. Thanks for joining us on Zero Hour. Rather than me bore people to death with resume, is there Jim or James? Which one are you more comfortable with?
Jim,
okay. Jim, would you just tell our listeners a little bit about your background, what you're doing now?
Sure. I'm actually a transplanted Texan, born and raised mostly in Texas. I came to Richmond and VCU in 1992 after I had just completed my graduate studies at the University of Texas in Austin, and I've been with the Department of Art History and the School of the Arts here ever since.
Oh, okay. And so you're chairing that now?
Actually, I'm the chair of the department. I've been doing that since 2002.
Okay. All right. But as you said before the interview, this has absolutely nothing to do with what we're getting ready to talk about. So
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But anyway, but it gives us some context. Howard, how about you?
Well, I've been here since 1980, and I'm retired now.
Yes.
And I'm liking it. and I was the chair of the craft department at VCU for 4 years before I retired. I've been retired 2 years now. And my background, University of Illinois, music and art, and also studied Mesoamerican art, pre-Columbian art in those days.
Okay. All right. Well, what's interesting about you two guys, and the reason I wanted to get you together is you're both obviously very well educated. And I'm going to be a little sarcastic here, so don't get up and walk out on me. But when most people think about drawings on rock or carvings on rock, especially the ones in the Southwest, visually they look fairly simple. And yet there's some fascination here for you guys. I mean, it's something the two of you do together. Jim, you were talking about, you know, belonging to an organization that actually has conferences associated with this. Why don't you share a little bit about how you got a passion for this? How did that happen? How did that come about for you, Jim?
Well, my professional engagement of this actually stems out of my area of specialization, which is pre-Columbian and Native American rock art, but pre-Columbian Native American art for the whole Western Hemisphere, basically. And
right.
So going all the way back into my graduate school studies, I actually started out being really interested in Mesoamerican art, that is art of Mexico, Central America, and even South American art. But in the process of studying this, I sort of became familiar with what was at the time and still is usually referred to as a rock art tradition from the American Southwest, which is one of the three or four great areas in the world for rock art studies. Some people may be familiar with, like, Australia has a great tradition, Africa, and probably the most famous ones are the cave paintings of France,
yes,
and Spain,
right.
Lascaux, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. These get a lot of attention in academic settings, that is to say, college students, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We're all, if you ever took any kind of art history course, you're probably familiar with those, but you probably never heard of the Southwest.
It was fascinating to read how prevalent, what a huge collection there is in the Southwest.
It actually is one of the more intense areas in the world to study this specific type of art. Now, that never really attracted me specifically to this area until I began looking at a very specific style that, as it turns out, is quite prevalent in the area. And as an art historian who was at the time training as a grad student and continued professionally after that, I began to sort of understand and realize that certain styles of this large tradition of rock art out there, from an art historical point of view, are better understood and much more interesting if we think of them as a true painting tradition. So this has been going on.
Well, that was something I was going to ask.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to get Howard in on this,
sure.
Too. But one of the things I was going to ask you is this archaeology? Is this art? Is this, what is this? You know, because you look at these. Go ahead, Howard.
Well, this is a discussion that Jim and I have had often, and uh-huh. and it's an interesting thing because we see the art historians in some ways pitted against the archaeologists, anthropologists, who say, well, these cultures have no word for art. This can't be art. And Jim
right.
and I have been arguing that these things are very sophisticated, and the kinds of devices that are used and the style has a tremendous aesthetic quality to it.
Like,
which,
for instance, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I mean, that is an interesting statement.
Well,
that they're very sophisticated and there are aesthetic qualities here. What comes
to
mind?
Well, for instance, if you see, there are a lot of animals in these styles, and if you see the way they're painted with such care, such attention to detail, and even placement of figures, this can't be just a desire to put down iconographical information that is, say, using these things as a sign to communicate a meaning. There's something in the style that also communicates meaning.
Yeah, so it's something beyond just, okay, so we went out and we killed ourselves a large buffalo, and we're come back and we're all so excited, we're just going to throw an image up on the wall. Do you both think there's much more going on here?
I think there's a lot more going on here. And in fact, my sort of initial interest in this and what still drives me doesn't have quite as much to do with what we would distinguish as the content of this imagery, the meaning of it, subject matter. There's a lot interesting going on there. But what actually got my attention is there's, from a technical point of view of actually painting and dealing with what we call pictorial issues in painting, there's some very sophisticated stuff going on in this style. For example, I've lectured about this quite a bit, and I've published a couple of articles on it, and I draw comparisons between some of these scenes and high Renaissance paintings.
Really?
Paintings by Raphael, if you're familiar with his School of Athens, which is one of the most famous uh-huh. paintings from the Renaissance tradition.
What parallels do you draw?
Well, for example, there's some very strong evidence that the painters in this Barrier Canyon style had developed a sort of a beginning or an incipient notion of illusionistic space.
Really?
If you're familiar with...
what does that mean?
Well, and when we teach art history classes, we often talk about the development of illusionistic painting, which has a long tradition, but we often highlight it in the Renaissance period. And, you know, Michelangelo, Raphael, all these people
depth
from the Renaissance.
Depth perception, that kind of thing.
Yeah, the idea of linear perspective. Mm-hmm. This is something that drives sort of a whole modern aesthetic about painting, is the attempt to create the illusion of a true three-dimensional space.
And you see that in these rocks?
Yes, I do.
And these are, again, because I was doing some reading, but these are paintings or primarily carved into the rock?
Well, you get both.
You do.
One of the things that can sort of get a little naughty here, and this is kind of goes right back to the whole anthropological question, you don't often hear them referred to as paintings, yeah. even though technically that's exactly what they are. They are pigment applied to a more or less flat surface.
Mm-hmm.
But you get other terminology, pictographs, petroglyphs, which don't really have good art historical definitions.
Right.
I can show, and I've shown several panels, and there's good supporting evidence to suggest that some of these artists were developing a sense of illusionistic painting and spatial depth, which is a pretty radical idea for this type of painting. And you can see how that sets up a much bigger discussion about the notion of how this develops as part of a painting tradition if you compare it to something like the Renaissance.
Well, let's talk
tradition.
About the culture. I mean, the culture that was surrounding this, right? I mean, the culture now, you've got artists working in studios who are caught up in the capitalist system, and their work is for sale, and it is valued or not valued, and they do it for a multitude of reasons. And yet you've got a culture of people who were at the time. What time period are you talking about? Are you going way back? Are you going 100 yeah. A.D.? 300 A.D.?
One of the most fascinating aspects about this specific style that we're dealing with is both interesting and highly problematic. Dating of this stuff is always a little bit tricky.
Right.
It's very difficult to get absolute dates, but all the evidence we have, both, and there is some supporting archaeological evidence, suggests that this is a fairly old style.
Mm-hmm.
We're probably looking at images, some of these images probably go back 5,000 or 6,000 years from now, so
really?
Maybe 4,000 or 5,000 B.C.
Right.
Some of them may not be quite that old. It seems to be not necessarily the very earliest in the area, but some of the earliest imagery in the area. And just from a chronological or dating point of view, that tends to grab people's interest to a certain extent. Predates most everything else you find in the Southwest, all the way up to and including the modern Puebloan peoples, which are sort of the dominant mm-hmm. groups out there now.
Does it make you think because it certainly makes me think, that art is as natural a part of our existence as breathing? That... I mean, if you
I
have
think it, art historian,
I mean, there was no one's buying this stuff back
well,
then. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
no,
much
but
less
but
even looking at it. Really,
Howard can address this too, because I know he's dealt with this a lot. But I think this is why Howard and I sort of get along on a lot of this. It's even more deeply fundamental than that. It is what makes us human on a certain level.
Yeah,
and you know, humans have always made art. Always, as long as we've been human,
right?
We have done things that, by argument, should and would be called art.
Called art.
So yeah. it's even more than just saying it's something we are driven to
do. Well, can you speak to that, Howard?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a...
Well, yeah, it's very complicated, but I think that certainly there's always the impulse to record things. That, I think, is a human impulse. And looking at the Barrier Canyon material, this 2000, maybe 3000, 4000 BC, there is other archaic stuff that's done around that time, but the Barrier Canyon stuff is so much more sophisticated. So one tends to think, and this is what Jim and I would argue, that it's not just a matter of recording, but the manner in which the recording is done conveys certain kinds of meanings, which right. is what place it in the realm of the aesthetic. Uh-huh. And one presumes, sure, there is an impulse to do this, but also to maybe convey something that's almost ineffable, that mm-hmm. can't be done in mm-hmm. sort of spoken language, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which is what artists try to do today as well.
Right. If I could, yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I've talked to people who've said, you know, well, Tim, you know, if I could talk about it, you know, why would I have to make a picture?
Right, and so something else is happening.
So something else is going on there.
Yeah. And I think this is why we have these sort of discussions with archaeologists and anthropologists, because this is not the realm in which they deal. Right. That is to say, this other kind of realm in which the information is so hard to grasp, but one has an experience of it which communicates certain kinds of meanings.
Yeah, interesting. What do they use to paint with? I mean, you know, painters, you know, today go down to the art supply store and buy brushes and paints. And I mean, how did they do this? How did they manage to do this?
Well, this is interesting. I think before the middle 19th century, artists made their own paints. This is
right.
all very new, that paint comes in
grind
tubes.
It up and, right.
But these are probably pigments that are ground up. And Jim and I have talked about what the binders would be, the thing that would hold the pigment to the wall. And there's talks about it maybe being blood, animal fat.
Animal fat's probably the most likely, but you can also use eggs, for example. And a point I always make to my students in my
eggs.
Classes that they always find interesting is just about every type of human bodily excretion.
Right.
Teach people a little word of wisdom. Makes a great paint binder. I mean, everything you can imagine will probably work. And they may well have used some of that. The most likely are either animal fats or plant saps.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of this imagery, and it does get visually rather compelling, meaning it gets large. We see figures out there painted on rock surfaces that can be 5, 6, 7 feet high.
Right.
And even more interesting, from a technical point of view, the pigment in some cases can be up to close to an eighth of an inch thick.
Really?
Now, what that tells me right up front is they've got to have a lot of binder and a mm-hmm. lot of paint to
yeah.
do that.
Yeah.
So before you ever even get into a discussion about what does it mean, what does it represent, why did they do it, I just get sort of knocked out by the technical fact that it exists, period.
Right.
And we sit for a long time saying, my God, how did they just paint this? The question you just asked,
exactly.
how did they do it? It's easy to say, well, they had some eggs that made the binder. Well, they must have had a lot. Or
right.
they butchered big animals to get a lot of fat. So the simple answer to your question is they painted them just like everybody else historically has always done paintings. You have a pigment, which usually comes from mineral, and the trick is you have to have a binder, something to make
right.
that pigment stick to the surface. And out there,
so the mineral can almost be from the soil out there.
Yeah,
I
mean, it's actually, this is why, like the other areas, it's one of the great areas for rock art, because mm-hmm. anyone that's familiar with the Southwest probably has visions of these polychrome canyons and the Grand Canyon and all
right.
this colored stone and that sort of things, typical for the area. Well, it makes great pigments,
right.
mineral pigments.
Yeah.
So there's plenty
yeah.
of that out there. You got mm-hmm. a huge natural resource of raw paint. You just have to figure out a way to make it stick to the surface.
<That's right>.
Yeah.
I never thought about the Southwest as a huge natural resource. Of
oh, well, you know, George O'Keefe, George O'Keefe knew this, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, you hear about things like the Taos School
uh-huh.
That developed in the 20th century, and you often hear discussions about, oh, they were out there because of the great light and then the great vistas and
well, that,
imagery,
yes.
and that's true. But they were also out there because it's a great place just to get the materials to do this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about the culture that surrounded this? I imagine that culture... Imagine we could spend hours talking about it, but they were primarily hunter-gatherers, so I'm assuming these places where they did these images were places where they would stop while they were hunting or moving or whatever. Later on, as they learned to grow their own food, they settled down more. Climate, of course, had an impact on how long they would stay in one place or,
yep.
or not. Give me a picture of what the culture was like.
Well,
because I think everybody thinks yeah. of... You know, most of us know nothing about this, so we think, well, there's a bunch of cave people,
you know, sitting around in fur, chopping away at the wall.
Yeah, well, that's sort of, in a perverted way, kind of accurate, but not probably as sophisticated. For this style, this Barrier Canyon style, we call it, these are principally what anthropologically referred to as archaic hunter-gatherers. They are roaming about the landscape. They have no permanent architecture, no ceramics. They don't live in any permanent sort of areas or dwellings. They tend to fit the sort of, not really the caveman stereotype, but they're migratory hunter-gatherers. So they would probably occupy, so to speak, a rather large areas out there. It's a very diverse climate. You have high mountains, you have deserts, you have forested areas in between, mesas, varied ecosystems, if you will. And they would roam around seasonally, following game, plants, that sort of thing. Now, as an art historian,
right,
what I find so interesting about this is a type of life and a type of people who, by and large, had very little in the way of any material culture at all.
When you say material culture,
I mean stuff.
They
have had a few rudimentary forms of body, sort of, we wouldn't even call it clothing, maybe just a wrapping, a loincloth, something mm-hmm. like that, maybe a skin to cover themselves mm-hmm. with. But tools, objects, like I say, none of the sort of material stuff we associate with sedentary lifestyles, like ceramics, for example.
Right.
This is before ceramics,
before baskets, before jewelry.
In fact, I often point out, and what makes this, again, this particular style so fascinating, is that if it were not for these paintings on these walls, we very well might not know that these people ever even existed.
Right.
And yet, when you look at these paintings, as paintings, they are remarkably sophisticated. Any way you want to look at them, from a technical point of view, from a subject matter point of view, and sort of from an ideological point of view, which is what Howard alluded to earlier. And it sets up a really interesting debate with sort of traditional anthropological theories about how cultures evolve and how art works in societies.
Right.
This is a group of people that produced virtually nothing else in terms of permanent material stuff, but they produced a very sophisticated and intellectually sophisticated painting tradition. So it sort of suggests that you don't need big buildings, you don't need gas-powered vehicles, you don't need computers to deal in a world where you have very sophisticated thought processes going on. And very intellectual and sophisticated approach to art, uh-huh. to how art works in society and how it's supposed
Any
to work.
Any sense of what their language might have been? At all? Not specific language, but do you believe they had language? Did they?
Well, they certainly probably had language. I mean, one of the other difficulties with dealing with these people is there's not even a good, even the anthropologists and historians don't agree on who, if any, the descendants of these folks were.
Really?
Some people say that our modern Puebloan peoples that live out there, and this is, if people are not that familiar with the Southwest, you're probably familiar with the Puebloan peoples that mm-hmm. are the dominant cultures that live out there today. We're talking about the Hopi and Zuni
and
some of the
Cliff Dwellers and that
right.
kind of.
There's some argument that maybe some of those groups were descendants from these earlier archaic peoples.
Right.
But there are just as many anthropologists say, oh no, and Native Americans for that matter.
So why
say,
no
oh.
why no remains? I mean, I was reading that, you know, in one particular culture, of course, they cremated people, and so that was sort of the end of that. But no skeletal remains?
Well,
no
there probably
DNA,
weren't that
no.
many of them, for one thing.
Uh-huh.
Even though we've got a lot of rock art imagery, you're talking about several millennia. You probably didn't have that many people per square mile, so there weren't that many around to leave anything behind to mm-hmm. begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, the truth is, nobody knows. There's a lot more speculation about this. Who were they? What did they speak? Where did they come from? Where did they go?
mm-hmm.
When they sort of dropped off the archaeological radar, we don't know. And I'm sort of ducking the issue a little bit, but one of the nice things about being art historians is we don't have to deal directly with those questions. We just look at the art and say, I know what the art's telling me, you know.
Right.
Well, Jim has done some interesting work and maybe offers a clue to some of these things. Because he did an article for an exhibition at an L.A. County Museum, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
and he had given a paper and they were interested. And it had to do with a kind of pan-American, Mesoamerican religious cult.
Pan-American, and, Mesoamerican, what does that mean?
Yeah, which means that it goes all the way back to, say, the Mayan culture, Aztecs, in Mexico, Honduras, those areas, and all the way into the Southwest, cults that have to do with snakes, for instance. And some of these Barrier Canyon paintings, I mean, many of them show people holding snakes in their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And we also see that their modern-day Hopi rituals do the same thing. They collect snakes at certain mm-hmm. times of the year. Mm-hmm. They actually put the snakes in their mouth. So there seems to be a connection. Now, the Hopi are, I think, Uto Aztecan speakers, which is a language base that goes back to Mesoamerica.
Mm-hmm. People it's like the language the Aztecs spoke.
Right.
Language of the Aztecs.
I think I remember reading something about Huco.
But the Navajo, for instance, are Athabascan speakers. Athabascans come down from Alaska, Canada.
Ah, really?
So it's a difference. So maybe these people were connected to the Udo Aztecans. Mm-hmm. Who knows? There is no material culture under the sites. And by the way, there are caves. They're not really caves. They're just alcoves.
Oh, yes. Okay.
So they're not caves that you're
so
going
sort
to.
Of overhanging.
Overhangs.
What was, and something interesting I was reading was how some of these are, you know, 10, 20 meters off the ground. Meaning, of course, that the erosion that has taken place since they were done. Not that these people were working on ladders.
But if there are sand and things, there is no archaeological evidence found by the paintings, which is one reason why it's so hard to date them or to talk about a cultural context.
What about just the meaning? I mean, we haven't really talked about that much. What are these? Do you have a sense of what they're
trying to say?
We
haven't talked about it because we like to dance around the question a little bit. Well, that's the big question that certainly people maybe outside the discipline or not that familiar with the tradition or certainly that they're just interested in art, that's always the big question. What do they mean? What are we looking at? And I always say right up front at the beginning, I don't know.
Mm.
I have some suspicions. I have some ideas, as does everybody else that looks at this stuff.
Really?
Because of all the issues we've already alluded to,
right.
It becomes very difficult to say, well, that figure must represent this type of thing or this activity or this must be what's going on in this. So most everything you will get from me and anybody else that's looked at this is speculation. Now, it's not just in the dark speculation. As Howard alluded, I've sort of made the argument that if we were to try to look at this imagery and try to compare it to what we know is going on elsewhere in the region at more or less the same time, what's happening in Mesoamerica to the south that's contemporary with this, what's happening in California, what's happening to the east, which
it's
would be the river.
Contemporary?
Well, contemporary
not
in the big
in terms
sense.
Of the imagery. But
I don't mean modern.
No. You just mean contemporary in terms of it's both going on at the same time.
Right. Well, while these people
but
are running around
talking
Utah.
To each other on the phone about what
no, but you know, while these folks are running around Utah making all these great cave paintings, there are other things going on throughout the Americas and certainly in the Southwest by other groups that archaeologically are not directly related but are contemporary with them.
Right.
Now, knowing that these people were hunter-gatherers, migratory, they covered a lot of territory. They certainly would have known about their neighbors. They would have known what was going on in the world. So one way to start to think about meaning is to say, well, what was everybody else doing and what would they think about this imagery? It looks like that a lot of the imagery is probably related to certain kinds of ritual activity that we often associate with shamanistic beliefs and roles of shamans or priests in societies.
Are you willing to put yourself out on a limb and say?
Well, I don't mind talking about it. It's not something that I've spent a great deal of time investigating any detail, partly because there are a couple of other scholars out there who've spent a lot of time working on the idea of shaman. The shaman is the priest.
Sure.
And there are a lot of euphemisms for him we use, right? Medicine man, holy man, that sort of thing. And there's a fair amount of evidence to support the idea that a lot of these images either depict shamans or priest in some sort of ritual behavior, or were produced by or as a result of ritual activity at the site. So the site where they're located may have been used for some sort of shamanistic ritual or practice, and the images somehow relate to that kind of activity. This is a rather popular way to think about this imagery because it tends to attract these sort of spiritual responses and sort of ooh and ah kind of responses from people. There's a little new age to it.
Yeah.
And I honestly don't know how far to go with this kind of interpretation, but there is enough evidence to support that some of this is probably what was going on.
I think
on.
Howard wants to talk about new age now.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. He's well versed on it, too.
Expertise.
Well, he's retired. What else has he got to do?
That's
you know?
Right.
But I think
there's a crystal around his neck,
but I do think there are other things going on with this imagery in terms of its meaning, its content, its subject matter that maybe aren't so spiritual, to be quite simple about it.
I mean, our whole concept of artist, right?
Right.
Okay? You know, which, of course, is distorted in many ways, because most good artists I know are hardworking, disciplined, you know, people. But the cultural thing is, you know, they're all drunks and crazies and, you know, outside of society. And somehow you don't get the sense of this guy in a loincloth, you know.
Well, this is always sort of the fundamental
sack of wine
question,
telling everybody to go to hell.
Yeah.
And, you know.
But Howard has actually dealt with this issue in some of the other areas that I know he's sort of interested in, done a lot of work in, that have nothing to do with rock art. Now, Howard has been interested in arts and crafts and,
right.
and craft production in other societies and other ways. But in funny ways, our ideas start to intersect about this. Because it becomes a question of the role of the artist and art in society. And I
right.
have argued that shamanism may be important in this, but I think these people were making art for the same reasons that humans have always made art, and there are a lot of reasons to do that. Spiritual, yes, that's important,
right.
but some of this may have been like signboarding, marking territory. We
sure.
were here.
Right.
Or, you know, here's who we are, here's what we're about. You
or
know,
here's what happened.
Yeah, some of it may have been to designate just like designate campsites or mm-hmm. a place where we stop. It's Holiday Inn.
I thought it was interesting as
stop
I was reading
here,
the material that there was a guy who had stopped in the 1850s, I guess, to look at this stuff, and he'd actually inscribed in the wall that he had been there.
Yeah.
And I thought, what an interesting, I mean, it's exactly the same thing,
well,
almost.
This is why know. The issue about, to me, what is so interesting about the fact that basically these people appear to have left very little of anything other kind of material culture behind. No other art forms.
Right.
I mean, there are a few little things that may be associated with them, but nothing at all. So if you think about it that way, then you have to look at this Berry Canyon style and see it as their almost their only, but certainly their primary artistic form of expression for their entire life, their entire
yeah.
world. Well, think of all the things we do with art in our culture. A computer screen is art, right? Television, movies.
Well, when
and
you say
things
forms
we,
of expression, I mean,
yes.
it was
well,
fascinating.
They had to condense all their forms right. of expression in a way
into
this, at least their visual forms of
right.
expression, into this art form. So,
right.
yeah, shamanism, spirituality, sure, that's there. But economics is in there. Social status is in there. Political histories. There's probably a lot of the scenes that depict episodes from legendary or mythical events.
Really?
They illustrated their Bible, if you will, which
really?
Is what all humans have done.
Yeah.
So it's an amazingly rich tradition, and we're just kind of starting to dig it out. But interestingly, from a theoretical point of view, it starts to intersect with some of what the things that Howard has been dealing with in a sort of a completely different realm, but theoretically it starts to overlap.
Well, we're getting short on time.
Yeah.
So, Howard, want to add anything to that?
Oh, no, I agree with Jim, and I do think the Renaissance notion of art, the role of art, was to make the invisible visible, and I think that's really what happens here. And
when you say that, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, you could talk about spiritual forces
okay.
or anything
okay.
to
okay.
make it visible.
Right.
And,
okay.
and when you look at some
okay.
of these paintings,
right.
there's a great panel that Jim and I have visited a couple of times called, I think it's called Sheep Ascending. And you see a figure standing with its arms out, and here is a row of sheep, single file, winding up to his arm, going across his arm, his shoulder, coming down the other arm, and turning into swallows and flying away. Now, I mean, how do you make that visible, right? I mean, there's something happening here. So shamanism...
it's not something you normally see. You know,
no, and shamanism would be, it's a sort of new age catch to make these things, I suppose, interesting. But they're interesting by themselves, I would
yeah,
say. And,
yeah.
and I think Jim and I found that there are probably sites that are revisited and the figures are repainted.
Yes.
And sometimes the figures are enlarged.
Right.
And we've also seen that even some later cultures have painted over some of these.
I know that was one of the
figures.
Things I thought was interesting was just, you know, that kind of like, not that I thought of it at the time, but, you know, the kids with spray cans, you know, who go out and paint and somebody will paint over top of it. But I thought, how interesting that you would be out, you know, in this culture, in a different culture, and come across this thing and decide to paint over it. I mean, it's sort of our obvious sort of dominance kind of. You know, I'm going to paint over your imagery. Did you?
Right. Well, you know, I think maybe, I mean, Vincent Scully talked about sacred places, that sacred places may change religion, but the places always remain sacred.
Yeah.
So you get a church over a Greek temple, you get a mosque
right.
over the church, things like that. And some of these sites may have been sacred places and that kept being revisited. And the repainting, certainly by Fremont or Anasazi, would
right.
be, you know, maybe 1,000, 1,500 years after the original.
Right,
so
right.
there may not have been a continuous cultural tradition, but the idea of a place being sacred. But I think within the Berry Canyon tradition, things were painted over, expanded, made more elaborate, are certainly kept up, like
uh-huh.
restoring and refreshing a painting
oh,
so
really?
That it remained
oh, interesting.
Active and vital.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right.
The,
well.
The art historical catchword is currency.
Mm-hmm.
They maintain currency over several thousands of years. They resonate even to Native American people that are like us. They don't really know what they mean.
Right.
They look at them and you ask them and they sort of are like, well, we're not sure. But they know they're important and they know they're significant. And so the painting over often sort of reflects, it's an act of reverence, if you will.
Okay, well, I'm afraid we are out of time, guys. It zooms by, and it really is fascinating. It's obvious that you could just go on about this for hours and hours and hours because, you know, you've got this stick-like anthropological, if I'm saying that correctly, form that is so revealing about a time so long ago. And what you said really struck me was, you know, that possibly their intelligence level or their ability to conceptualize was as almost as sophisticated as ours. It's just that they were limited to a rock, you know, a pigment, whatever, and that their cultures were complicated and complex. Well, anyway, thank you both for coming today and sharing about this. And thank you, folks, for listening. We hope to see you again for lunch on the radio next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM. It's Richmond's Indie Radio. It's our radio for the rest of us.